Welcome to Stone's Notes by Stone Consulting. I'm Maureen Stonehouse. On today's episode, I'm talking to Ross Crane, an expert petrophysicist. Ross has worked on projects in 45 countries, on 6 continents, and across several oceans over his 60-year career. We'll be talking about Ross Crane's e-textbook titled Crane's Petrophysical Handbook. Some highlights include discussing a go-to petrophysical tool. We're rocking out today with Ross Crane. Welcome to Stone's Notes. Well, welcome to the show, Ross. It's very nice to have you with us today.
Well, I'm very happy that you decided to interview. I'm new at this, so you'll have to excuse any lapses of memory and so on.
Well, your book, Crane's Petrophysical Handbook, has been around for a very long time. I know my entire career, I've been working with it. The online version's been out for 20 years, and the hard copy version you came out with in 1986. So it's been around my entire life, and many other geologists would have a similar story. So you did have an article about how Crane's Petrophysical Handbook came to be written. Can you fill us in on what motivated you to write this?
Well, it started, of course, way back when. I had to keep notes for myself because you can't remember all this stuff from one week to the next. And I had taken on a number of jobs that kind of took me away from petrophysics for a little while, although it was always in the background of my work. And so my notes turned into course notes as I started teaching courses. And that turned into the textbook, as you mentioned, in 1986. And then when I update and additional material looked like it should be published, I realized that it would never get published in paper the way the original book was, because it's a very expensive process and they can't print a whole lot of copies and so on. And the internet was becoming practical in 1999 when I started using it for email and things like that. And so I decided, okay, let's put the book up on the internet. And so the original textbook turned into the first group of topics that were on the Crane's Petrophysical Handbook on the web for starting in 1999 and onwards. And then as I finished the material for what was going to be the second textbook, I just decided to put that up on the website as well. So that's how it got started. It was my own need for notes that really got this thing moving.
It's so true. It's really hard to remember all the formulas, and we do take such good notes and they're beneficial to other geologists. So it's really great that you were able to share that and put that out for others to utilize. So for people that use logs all the time, most of us know what well logs are used for, but you did send me a recording of an overview where you talked about what logs were used for. And I thought it was really great because you had a really big breadth and number of activities, and some of them were surprising of why we would use logs. So can you inform everyone, what are well logs used for?
Well, there's such a breadth of activities, but everybody that works in the science part of the oil business, that includes geophysicists in the seismic side of the world, the geologists who work in all kinds of different ventures inside the oil and gas business, engineers, of course, reservoir engineers, completion engineers, workover engineers, you name them, they're out there doing jobs. And all of them rely on petrophysics log analysis to some degree, where to perforate, what's wrong with this well, why is it not performing, and all those kinds of questions. And so for each of those individuals that might use logs, there's about 5 or 10 to 20 different activities that well logging might help with. For example, in seismic, we use logs to judge the quality of our seismic inversions, for example. We might want a Poisson's ratio inversion. I mean, it's a very esoteric idea, but it works like darn. And you need the log calibration of numbers derived from the logs to make sure that your seismic inversion was worthwhile and is interpretable or understandable by outsiders. Same is true in reservoir engineering. If you're trying to decide whether you've optimized the performance of this well, you need to look very carefully at the petrophysical analysis to see if you've got the perfs in the right place. If it's a horizontal well, is it in the right place? I have some examples in that first course lecture of mine of horizontals that didn't work. And of course, that's an economic loss to the company who ran the well. And if petrophysics had been done in advance instead of as a postmortem, we might have been able to avoid the problem, or at least reduce the expense of the problem. So that's a couple of the things that logs are used for. The list in my slideshow, though, runs on for about 11 slides, I think, each of them with 5 or 10 items on them. So it's a huge breadth and scope of activity that logs are used for.
Yeah, and petrophysics, the way you put it is so true. It needs to be done up front instead of as a look back at the end, because it does enlighten you and tell you more about the rocks and the fluids in there. And you can really get a good sense of where the best reservoir is if you just use the logs. You refer to it a lot as integrated petrophysics, which I think has a nice ring to it. What would you say is the difference between just normal petrophysics and integrated petrophysics?
Well, an awful lot of petrophysics is truly just log analysis. They look at the logs, they look at what happened at the well while it was being drilled, things like that. They probably look at the sample descriptions, but that's as far as their integration goes. But integration needs some historical and some local and probably regional knowledge as well. You can look at all the neighbor wells within the area that you're working in. That's an awful lot of data, but it's worth doing. You might only need to look at 2 or 3 or 4 neighbor wells, but at least it's a sign or a guide to what you need to do in your current drilling well, as far as analysis goes. But integration involves a lot of other kinds of data, not just what you get at the well more directly, but for example, core analysis, special core analysis, X-ray diffraction data for mineralogy, especially in unconventional reservoirs. We need to know what kind of clay is there. We need to know what the clay to non-clay mixture ratio is, for example. Because this is not going to come easily from these newer types of reservoir using log analysis alone. It needs to be calibrated to what we would call ground truth. And so the idea of integration is find everything. I find production histories extremely useful, as they give me an idea of the quality of the reservoir without knowing anything about the reservoir. And I can look at my logs and cores and lithology information and see if I can make sense, make them reconcile, so that I can tell a good story about the quality of this reservoir.
Yeah, and using all the different data types and making sure they match, you really do get such a deeper understanding of what you're looking at. You started to touch there a little bit on calibration and all the data that goes into your earth model. You really need to calibrate it. The way the minerals and the fluids show up in the logs, you need to verify it against actual hard lab rock data. So if you were to calibrate a well log, what would your process be?
Well, the steps are actually quite straightforward in the petrophysical sense. They may seem out of order from some other point of view, like a geological point of view. They're interested in slightly different things as a rule. But in my case, the list of things that we get for answers, like shale volume, porosity, water resistivity, water saturation, permeability, and so on, those all have to be calibrated in that order, because if you don't have the first item right, then none of the following items will be right. You know, it's impossible to get a good log analysis unless every step is calibrated along the way. And so we do our shale volume calculation. It's the first thing that you do, in your mind at least, and in practice in the mathematics. So how do we calibrate it? Well, we use the X-ray diffraction data, for example. Sometimes sample descriptions are enough to get you started. But again, with unconventional reservoirs, you need hard physical data, and XRD or thin section point counts are the way to go. Once you get your shale volume right, the next step is effective porosity. So you correct for shale, and if there's kerogen present, you correct for kerogen. And then you check your log analysis answer porosity against the core analysis porosity. If they don't match, well, you can touch up the shale volume correction a bit. You can touch up the kerogen correction a bit. If there's a mineral correction to apply, you do it. And that finishes step number two, and you go on like this for the entire list of 7 or 8 or 9 items that you calculate in log analysis. And each step of the way, you learn more. You also learn what you don't know, and that is, core data is missing, for example, or there's no core in this well. Let's go look at another well that does have core. So it's a very iterative process from beginning to end, and involves getting outside of your well quite often, because we don't take enough information in a lot of our wells to do a decent calibration on a specific well. But we can do it for a group of wells in an area.
Yeah, and that's such a good point, that you really need to go through step by step. And if you skip a step, your next answer is going to be the wrong answer. So then you need to go back, get more data, really fine tune the shale volume before you move on, for example. So if we're to dig a little bit deeper, one of the petrophysical outputs that's talked about a lot is effective porosity. You want to use effective porosity, excluding the claybound water and kerogen, instead of using the total porosity to really get your volumetrics correct. So let's talk a little bit about the shale and kerogen corrections and the best way to really get those.
Well, the shale correction, we've been doing it for many, many years, of course, and we've been using the gamma ray log as our primary curve for estimating shale volume. And then we go and look at the shales on the log near the zone of interest and find out what the logs read in those intervals. For example, the density log reads a certain value, the neutron log will read a certain value. And we assume, okay, that shale, let's assume those numbers represent 100% shale. Well, what does 10% shale represent? Well, you can do the math to work out what the effect of 10% shale volume will do to the density and the neutron. So you back out the porosity that appears to be caused by the claybound water from each of the density, the neutron, the sonic. And these are now shale corrected logs in the interval of interest. The shale properties, of course, vary up and down the borehole. So you have to do this with a unique set of numbers for each reservoir that you're working with. They even vary laterally across fields sometimes. So you have to, you know, keep looking at the shale properties and figure out what to use in this particular well as opposed to a field-wide average. Sometimes the field is uniform enough. You have one number for each of these corrections. But if it's a large field, like I did Lake Maracaibo a few years ago, and from north to south, east to west across that huge field, yes, all these properties did change. So you got to do it at every data point, really, or every reservoir interval that you're looking at. And if they don't change much, well, that's fine. You move ahead. So that's how we would correct the logs. And once we have that, we have models for getting porosity from a shale corrected log. The one I like the best is the complex lithology model. The model's not complex. It just, it'll handle complex rocks if they're there. If they're simple rocks, it'll handle that too. So the complex lithology model takes the density neutron. You shale correct both curves individually. You correct kerogen, correct them if needed. And you take the average of those two answers. And it's a really beautiful model, because once you're done that little piece of math, it's almost independent of mineralogy. So whether you're in a dolomite or a limestone or a sandstone with 50% dolomite, the answer is very close to the truth. And that is the truth being measured by the core analysis. So that shale correction, by correcting each log individually with unique numbers for that reservoir, and then using the complex lithology model, gets us a really good porosity answer and suitable for anything you want to do next, which should be, for example, water saturation needs that number, reserves calculation needs that number, pressure transient analysis needs that number. So you can see where even that simple number of porosity transmits itself all over the industry.
Yeah, porosity really does trickle down into all other inputs going forward. And you talked a bit about the V-shale correction being so important to getting the porosity right. Now, before we do the V-shale correction, there's the gamma ray normalization, which there is some debate around whether or not it's necessary, if doing it overcorrects the logs, or if it really impacts it and makes it more accurate porosity. What's your take on the gamma ray normalization?
It varies on what you want to use it for. If you're correlating logs across a large area, normalization is helpful in picking tops and deciding whether a zone has thinned out or eroded away or whatever. But from a computational point of view, the normalization is in the factors that we use. For example, we pick a clean line and a shale line, and that automatically normalizes that log to 100% shale and to clean sand, for example. And so the numbers might be different in every well, but the answer is has already been normalized by the nature of the mathematics involved in calculating shale volume. Now, if you want to make your logs and cross sections look prettier, well, yeah, normalize the gamma ray, make the clean line always 25 API units, make the shale line 125, for example. And it makes it easier for the eye to see the correlations between one zone and another, but it doesn't affect the numerical answer. Where it does go crosswise sometimes is that you don't recognize where the clean line really ought to be. And you make it clean by default, and it turns out that, no, that's 20% shale. And normalization will remove some geological variations from well to well that you might want to hang on to. So it's a task that has its uses, but I don't normally do it for quantitative log analysis. I only do it if the client wants to make really pretty cross-sections.
That's such a good way of looking at it. Use it to help correlate your well logs, really see where the sand packages are. But for the quantitative numbers, you might get the wrong answer by using it. And even picking where the shale line is, you know, sometimes it'll help you identify a reservoir where you think it's a shale, but then when you use it as a shale line, you start to realize there might be more sand content in there than originally expected.
Well, that's quite true, especially at our Cretaceous section here in Western Canada, that an awful lot of shales are not really, you know, solid black shales. They are a mix of many things. And so our shale line is often pretty arbitrary. And fortunately, we're looking at the cleaner sand, so it doesn't hurt us too badly. But it can reduce our apparent porosity. That's the porosity we believe to be there. It can reduce porosity a little bit and therefore make you slightly pessimistic. So, you know, the less normalization you do and the cross-checks that can be applied, of course, because we may have another method for finding shale volume, such as the density neutron separation between the two curves. If it's greater than the value of shale volume from, say, the gamma ray, then you better look at it more carefully and see if did I underestimate shale volume on the gamma ray, or is the density neutron seeing other minerals, which is very common. Density is affected by calcite, siderite, dolomite, all these things that might be in a sand. And so it's suggesting, you know, more shale than the gamma ray because of mineralogy, not because of shale. So it's a very tricky business. You have to be aware of the possibilities of what the minerals might be. And that's where the sample descriptions are so valuable. We need that well site information to recognize whether or not we have a super clean quartz sand or whether we have a dolomitic sand. You can be 6-8% porosity wrong if you don't know the difference. So it's very important. So yeah, it's scary.
The cuttings and the XRD and the sample descriptions, you can also use those as inputs into the mineral model. And you have the 3-mineral model and the 2-mineral model. And I've seen those in the past, often used in the Montney and the Duvernay, so really heavily used in shale plays, but other more conventional ones, it's not used as often in. Do you think it's being underutilized, or is that how you would use it as well?
Well, I always used it in all plays, let's put it that way, even you know, any simple Alberta sand, the glauconitic sand or something like that. I always did the mineral model because there is always something else besides quartz in those sands. The chance of getting a pure quartz sandstone is so rare that you should use it all the time. Now, there's an awful lot of people use the density log as their porosity indicator log, and they don't want to do the math. They don't want to do the fancy petrophysical work. And so they use the density porosity just the way it is on the log. And that's very scary because, like I say, it can be 6-8% porosity wrong if you don't have the mineralogy figured out. Halfway between the density and neutron is a way better way to go, but very few people use that. Density just seems so simple and so clear cut, but that's only for clean quartz sands. It doesn't work in other mixtures. So you need to do the work, and say halfway between density and neutron is a very good approach for solving the mineral problem, as long as the zone is still fairly clean. Some of that separation is due to shale. So it's hard to separate the shale and the lithology without going through that step-by-step procedure we've mentioned, shale volume, effective porosity, and then lithology and mineralogy in that order. So that requires a map. That requires software to do the work.
Even within a reservoir, you could have the mineralogy changing, right? So you could have a more quartz-rich shoreline and a more feldspar-rich incised valley, and that could affect the porosity within the same formation, having different depositional environments.
Well, that's very true, and that's why, you know, the computerized log analysis with the, you know, 2 and 3 mineral model is already built into your software. You might as well run it. It's free. I mean, it doesn't cost anything to do it. So just do that kind of analysis. You'll see these mineral differences from top to bottom throughout the reservoirs. I've done an awful lot of Montneys, and even the Montney varies a lot from, 50-50 quartz and dolomite to some much less dolomite, some much more dolomite. Look at the Bakken, the same thing is true. It's on average 50-50 quartz and dolomite, but there's pyrite in there. And when the pyrite shows up, you might see it on the resistivity log, you might not. But if you see it in the mineral mixture, you can say, aha, a lot of pyrite's very heavy, so it makes the porosity even more pessimistic from the logs than it truly is. And it's pessimistic enough to begin with, so don't make it worse.
Exactly. So once you get the minerals right, you can move on to the water saturation and really get a good understanding of that. You've recommended to always start with the Simandow equation as a rule of thumb and apply the shale correction to the resistivity there. So the A, M, and N values really affect the SW that you wind up getting in the end. What would you do to make sure you're using the correct A, M, and N values?
Well, there's two ways to approach it, and both might need a little help from time to time. But the first one is get your A, M, and N from the special core analysis procedure that gets the electrical properties from core data. And carry those numbers around anyway. You might not use them directly because I've found that sometimes they are a little lower than they should be, let's put it that way. And as a result, you get too much hydrocarbon. When the A, M, and N values are low, you get more hydrocarbon than if they're high. Now, the second way to go about it is to calibrate your log analysis water saturation to the core analysis water saturation. This is totally independent of the M and N that were found in the lab. And in most reservoirs today, I'm talking maybe the last 20 years or more, the water saturation in the core is fairly close to the irreducible water saturation. Now, it was flushed while coring. It was evaporated while in transit and things like that. But the net result when it's in the lab, for some reason, I think it's the humidity control and so on that they apply to these cores, allows the water saturation to kind of reestablish itself as a air-water mixture in the reservoir. And as a result, that water saturation seems to be fairly reliable these days as a baseline for your irreducible water saturation, which is the number we're trying to achieve with our log analysis. So that's two totally independent ways to find out what your M and N ought to be by trial and error. What do you need to change M to make the water saturation match the core analysis? And we have found that in many of the unconventional reservoirs, they are quite a bit lower than the world average numbers that we've tended to use in sandstones. For example, 1.7, 1.8 for M and N instead of 2 or 2.15 or numbers like that. In carbonates, it's more difficult because we have a lot of different pore geometries in many of our carbonates, and that's true around the world. And M and N tend to be treated as a constant, but they're not. There are variable M methods, for example, that have been proposed by at least a half a dozen different authors. And they're in the website somewhere for variable M. And then we assume that N is going to track the value of M. So we would probably make them equal to each other for lack of better information. So there's a third, that's a third way of looking at your M and N problem. It's non-trivial, but it's very difficult to solve because we don't go to the lab often enough. We don't gather the data into catalogs like we do the RW data. It'd be really nice to see an A, M, and N catalog, just like RW. Bother to build it. It would be a tedious job, no doubt about it.
It would be great to have a catalog of that. And I imagine, similar to RW, you have the catalog with the data points changing quite quickly geographically. If you map all over Alberta, you really need that RW map in there. So same with AM and M. If you're using a constant across your whole Alberta fairway, it's probably not accurate because the parameters in the south and the north would be quite different.
I was just going to say that's quite right because we fought the battle across the Montney, which is a pretty big piece of ground out there, and it does vary east to west and north to south.
Yeah, and using the RW catalog that you have is really, it's quite a good resource, and it's significant to be able to use it. Another parameter we look at a lot is the permeability, and you've suggested using the Wiley-Rose equation in low porosity reservoirs. So if you have a really fractured reservoir, do you expect it to be picked up in the permeability, or is there a better log to use to pick up on these fractures?
Yeah, for the typical equations that we use for permeability are for the intergranular permeability only. They don't count fractures at all. So Wiley-Rose, Teemler, even a porosity permeability crossflot, for example, won't touch fractures. All you'll see is the scatter of data caused by the fractures. There is a way to do it, and that's through the image log processing itself. And unfortunately, there's two ways to use your image log for fracture: aperture. And aperture is, permeability and porosity of the fracture are both functions of that aperture, the openness of your fracture. Now, typical fractures are only microns to a millimeter in size, so they're not very big in the first place. So porosity is very low. But permeability can still be up in the thousands, 2,000s, 10,000 millidarcies. And the solution is the appropriate use of the image log, resistivity image log in particular. You can just look at the image and see the size or the count of pixels that are black, for example, on an image log. And it's either shale or it's a fracture. Take your pick. And we can usually tell one from the other. But that exceeds, or the image log tends to exaggerate the size of a fracture because there's only so many pixels available. There's an alternate method that Schlumberger had used some years ago, and I used it in a Vietnam situation, where they actually use the Archie equation and the resistivity from the image log curves themselves to calculate the aperture of the fracture by estimating, doing a back calculation of Archie's 100% water saturation equation. And because we've invaded the fracture of a drilling fluid, we can get away with this. So it's like calculating porosity from a water zone, in essence, but it's using the micro resistivity logging curves to do it. I think the process is probably still available through the service companies, but some people just like counting pixels on their image. And I'd say that overestimates your fracture width or aperture, and the result is you overestimate fracture permeability by quite a bit.
It's interesting to look at it that way. You really need to take into account the drilling fluid that went into the fracture to figure out what your fracture is looking like and calculate it properly.
Yeah, well, that's the technically superior way to do it. Let's put it that way. However, it does, you have to extract these individual resistivity curves one at a time from your image log. And you have to have the right software to do the inversion of the resistivity back to a porosity, which goes back to the width of the fracture. And it's so much easier and faster just to look at the image log. But the practical solution is, let's look at it, let's calculate the number, but then in my back of my mind, I just divide by 10 or something like that to get the permeability back into the realm of reasonableness.
Having the right software is so important. I'm sure over your 60 years of your career, you've seen quite the change in software capabilities and what it can do. What do you think of running batch calculations versus individually looking at wells?
I prefer doing a well at a time, one zone in a well at a time, even no matter how good the software might be doing at batching. If you got to a point of, I've got a cardium, for example, and I understand it fairly well, and I'm going to do, these zones within the cardium, because it does, it's a coarsening upward sequence, you will treat the lower part quite a bit differently than the upper part, possibly. Once you've got the routine working, you can do batches. Now, I've done batches. We did a study of you know, all the shallow gas from Calgary to Regina, for example, for a company one time. And you have to cut a lot of corners. You have to make a lot of simplifications. But from an overall point of view, it was quite successful. It turned out that we also serviced the coal industry, because every time we flagged the coal people, coal bed methane people got interested. So sometimes batch jobs can do you know, more than you expect them to do. But a single field, even a smaller field, I would be reluctant. We did each well one at a time, even if there was 300 wells, because the log age varies, and therefore some of the calibration steps vary. This problem you mentioned about normalization earlier does show up even on density logs and sometimes on neutron and sonic logs. And so you have to be careful about each well. You can't use universal parameters across the whole field very often.
There is such a variability in the logs that you wind up getting. And even back in the 60s, it was micro logs that you had more often than the standard conventional log suite. So if all you have is these really old logs and you have two of them to work with, what would you include these in your analysis? Would you pull in more data? What would you do with them?
What we did with situations like that, the Lake Maracaibo was like that because it had 80 years worth of logs, I swear. And something like well over half to three quarters were ancient logs by our normal standards. That is an electrical survey and gamma ray through casing while, you know, completing the well. And that was it. You know, you got your gamma ray to get shale volume. There's a method for taking the shale volume and estimating porosity. We did that for all of Lake Maracaibo. In Alberta here, we've done it dozens of times in older fields. And the people are drilling new wells in a lot of these older fields, especially horizontal wells. And they'd like to know where is the good pay in, say, the Cardium or Dunvegan or something like that. We've drilled it before, but we never decided where was the best part. Yeah. And so the microlog is actually extremely good for that. I did a project where we doubled what was called good quality pay just by using the microlog, because they've been using the resistivity alone, you know, to estimate high resistivity was good pay. Well, it's not always. It could be low porosity. It could be a whole lot of laminated, you know, tight streaks amongst your porosity. And that's where the microlog really held its own in the past. You can still run it today. You can put a microlog pad on a density log and run it at the same time as a density. It doesn't cost you anything to do it. So if you're looking at thin bed stuff like the second white specs, like the Cardium with all its shale interbeds and much of the upper Mandel and so on, microlog's a great tool. And so even our ancient logs still have very valuable uses. And I've taught the course quite a few times to companies who purposely went out looking at their ancient logs in the files and finding out what else can we know about this reservoir that we didn't know before.
So using these micro logs in a reservoir like the Cardium, where oftentimes you do really focus on the resistivity, it can reveal a lot additional data. And you even suggest running it on newer wells, hey?
Oh, I would recommend it, certainly. And I do from time to time. And when I can prove it, especially with the availability of older logs, you can show people, you know, what this log tells you that the other logs don't get around to because of the bed thickness issues.
Exactly. So if the model doesn't work well, you wind up needing to go back to the lab to get more answers. And you can do multiple iterations of this. So if you were to go back to the lab to fix your model, how many data points would you suggest getting? And after you incorporate it, how would you decide if your model is good enough or if you need another iteration?
Well, the numbers, of course, will vary a lot with the type of reservoir. But if you're looking at a Montney, for example, once you've learned the M&N information from your lab data and applied it and checked your water saturation against the core analysis, water saturation, and so on, you're pretty well done the fussing in the laboratory. Where it's difficult is when you don't have the experience yet on that reservoir. Like the first days of my Montney analysis was terrible. No, very much. You know, tomorrow I could do you a hell of a good job just from memory. Yeah. But if anytime you get into a new play, you need to go make your assumptions to begin with and then go to the lab. I would recommend that, for example, if you needed X-ray diffraction data for shale volume, you want to take samples from, maybe 10-foot intervals through a 100-foot reservoir. So that's 10 samples to go to the lab. It's not a lot of money. It's $200 a sample, I think, give or take inflation. But that's a couple of $1,000s worth of effort. So that's a really low-cost help to your analysis. Some of the other things you have to do in the lab, like the electrical properties or special core analysis or capillary pressure is another very useful thing to help us understand water saturation. Where are we on the capillary pressure curve, for example? Are we well above the oil, the free water contact or not? Things like that. So probably we only do four or five, six samples for cap pressure and for pore throat size in any reservoir. You probably don't need much more than that. If you have a wide enough range of porosity or pore geometry in your samples, then you have at least maybe two samples from each of your major rock types, let's call them. I did a job in Libya some time ago. It was in the Mediterranean Sea, and the analysts had decided that the reservoir was entirely a transition zone because the water saturation was increasing with depth. And it wasn't changing with depth, it was changing with pore geometry. And the proof was right on the plots that they were working with. They had the perforated interval, and they had the water cut all in the same depth plot. And the perforated interval went right down to the water contact, and they weren't making very much water, 3, 4, 5% water set, water cut. And that means it's not a transition zone, and yet they had interpreted it this way, just because they didn't have the physical data. What they had was perforations and water cut. So, that tells you such a great deal about the reservoir. It'll never come from the lab. And so there's lots of things to use or do in the lab. There's lots of things to do from the practical production side of the business to turn it into part of your log analysis. So that's where the integration really plays a role, is looking at as much as you can find about these wells.
So in the field of integrated petrophysics, it's really interesting. And I feel like we could really talk about it for days or weeks. There's so much to learn and discuss and find details to look at. A lot of oil and gas companies, the geoscience staff is shrinking and condensing. So now, instead of having in-house petrophysical teams, a lot of geologists are doing their own petrophysics. So what would you say is kind of a key understanding that geologists really need to know to make sure they do their own petrophysics properly? I know, like, referring back to Crane's Petrophysical Handbook is amazing, such a good place to go. What else would you recommend?
The topics are broad and very large, and there's many, many options in the given in the handbook, many of which you wouldn't want to attempt. But they're there because sometimes you have to use that model as opposed to want to use the model. I think geologists need to know that step-by-step procedure of shale, porosity, water saturation, lithology sort of thing, and permeability at the end if you care to. Unless you do it in enough detail, you will make some big mistakes sometimes, not every time. Like I say, the mineralogy can change your density porosity by 6 or 8% porosity. That's a big chunk of change. So I think they need to understand the limitations of the simplified, very simplified methods. And if you use a spreadsheet, and their spreadsheets can be downloaded for free from my website. So there's a model out there called MetaQuick. It's a quick look log analysis, but it forces you to actually pick all the log data for a single zone or multiple zones, if you wish, but at least one zone. You have to pick Masonic, density, neutron, gamma ray, SP, whatever you've got, resistivity, and write them down in this spreadsheet. Type in those numbers, but it's a trivial task because you're just typing eight numbers. And then put in the parameters for the shale properties, which again is another maybe five or six numbers that you have to type in. And the answers are all right there, right now. The math is already written for you. The equations work. And if you pick reasonable values for the raw data for the interval of interest and for the shale interval, the answers will pop out directly, one data point or one level in your reservoir at a time. And it's far better than trying to just use the simple, you know, let's use the density log and forget about every other piece of information we might already own. So I would strongly recommend that, you know, geologists get used to the idea of using spreadsheets, do the work. That way they also have something they can print, they can give it to the boss, you know, they can give it to somebody in the engineering department who needs these numbers just by printing that spreadsheet out or even passing it on as a PDF or whatever. So there are easy ways to do the task that force you to be a little bit logical about it all, as opposed to just pointing at the log and saying it's 12% porosity. You can do better than that for no more time than it takes to point your finger at the log.
That's a great suggestion. I want to Google it right now. Go find the MetaQuick spreadsheet on your website, right?
Yeah, it's the MetaQuick. If you just go to the website on the left-hand margin, there's the list of things you can go to, the navigation pane on the left-hand side. One of them is downloads and spreadsheets. And there's 28 spreadsheets altogether, but the one that everybody uses is the MetaQuick spreadsheet. There are more complex spreadsheets, and there's also stuff for other activities altogether. If you want to model, what should a log read if it's missing? You know, things like that, and spreadsheets work for that too. And if you're in the shale oil business, there's a spreadsheet for handling shale oil. Things like that are out on the website. But the MetaQuick is the one that the typical geologist would go to.
That's fantastic. Well, this has been so much fun. I'm really glad you took the time to chat. I know I've heard of you lots in the past, so it's been really great to meet you and get some more insight from you.
Well, I appreciate the chance to sermonize a little bit how I think log analysis should be done. It was great chatting with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Stone's Notes is brought to you by Stone Consulting. We can be found online at www.stoneconsulting.info or send us an email anytime at stoneconsultingcorp@outlook.com. On behalf of everyone here, I'm Maureen Stonehouse. Thanks for joining us. Until next time.